What's the outlook for GP-led secondaries activity in 2024? What opportunities are there to be found in the lower mid-market in particular? And how does the topic of GP-leds fit into the wider themes of private equity exits, GP-LP dynamics, and industry consolidation? We'll be discussing all this and more with a guest interview from Elena Lale from Klein Hill Partners in today's episode of the Unquote Private Equity Podcast by Merger Market. Hello, listener, and welcome to this new episode of the Unquote Private Equity Podcast by Merger Market. My name's Harriet Matthews. I'm funds editor at Merger Market, and I'll be your host for today's episode, in which we're going to be discussing GP-led secondaries, namely the outlook for these kinds of deals or funds in 2024, and how GPs and secondaries buyers are approaching them in the current market. Later in this episode, we'll be hearing from Elena Lale, a managing director at US headquartered secondaries investor Klein Hill Partners. But before that, to join me in discussing this topic, I would like to welcome again Rachel Lewis, senior private equity reporter at Merger Market. Rachel, hello and welcome.
Hi, Harriet, and it's great to be back on the podcast.
Yep, absolutely. Great to have you as always. Now, back in Q1 2023, I think was the last time we kind of covered GP-led secondaries on the podcast in any depth. That certainly doesn't mean that we haven't been writing about and thinking about them, of course, because they seem to increasingly come up, you know, as M&A exit options and in our conversations with market participants. But, you know, back then we were talking a bit, or our colleague Min rather was talking a bit about people using GP-led secondaries in part as a means to keep holding on to assets and to hold off on exits at a time where buyer and seller valuation gaps were particularly prominent. And GPs at the time were also, of course, making the argument about wanting to hold on to their best assets for longer. At the same time, we were also hearing a bit about LP frustration about the number of these vehicles that they were having to review. But of course, you know, that was a year ago. We've had another, you know, quite challenging year for the private equity industry since then in terms of deal flow and exits, of course. So, Rachel, you know, what would you say has kind of changed in the market since then? Why is it worth us revisiting the topic of GP-led secondaries now?
So the big answer to that question is a lot has changed. Everyone listening to this podcast at home will know quite how difficult 2023 has been for both GPs and LPs in terms of liquidity. I think at Q1 last year, we were really kind of only six months or so into that initial difficult trading environment, and there was very limited visibility on when that might improve. And even now we're sat here a year later, we're only just beginning to see the shoots of that recovery. So liquidity was restrained all the way back in Q1. It's perhaps, you know, we've seen some exits, we've seen some other realization methods, but it still remains severely constrained. And I think your point as well around what is the point of a continuation vehicle? That has changed as well. There was a whole, I always thought of it as kind of like a PR spin when continuations started to pick up again in the market, because sponsors were telling us, oh, these are for our best assets. And, you know, it's easy to say that, but how do you prove it? But now we've got visibility on who's buying them and the advisors, and it comes up in the interview that we're about to listen to. But these, I think, really are for the best assets in this environment, which I think is a huge shift from the whole concept of when the continuation vehicle was invented or created, because that was just to deal predominantly with the tail end of the portfolio.
Yeah, I think they're definitely established as a kind of viable route for the best assets now, as you said, and we're definitely seeing kind of evidence of that. We're also seeing evidence of, you know, continuing good LP appetite for secondaries funds. And I wanted to revisit some of our kind of fundraising data around secondaries to set the scene here. So in 2023, we saw 47.3 billion euros raised by secondaries funds that have a European mandate, at least in part. So, you know, our data, of course, does track, you know, kind of US headquartered managers like Blackstone and Goldman Sachs, those kinds of players. But, you know, they do have a European element to them. So 47.3 billion euros and 16 funds in 2023. That was, you know, taking into account the kind of the rest of the private equity fundraising space, that accounts for 14% of the total capital raised in that period. That's the highest percentage we've seen since 2020, and it's also the highest total we've seen since 2020. Although 2020 was still pretty significantly above that, so 72.4 billion euros raised across 35 funds. So, you know, kind of around nearly double or around double in terms of both the fund count and the kind of actual, you know, aggregate volume of funds raised. And in that year, 2020, there were five funds that were more than 5 billion euros in size, kind of in the mix. And, you know, of course, that meant the secondaries fundraising then, you know, accounted for about 20% of the total raised across kind of all of European private equity. So, you know, people like Ardian, Lexington, Alpenvest, Harbourvest, and Goldman Sachs back then, whenever any of those managers are in the market, you know that there's going to be a big kind of secondaries fundraise, you know, kind of multi-billion size. But it hasn't, you know, 2023 was a difficult fundraising year, but the secondary space hasn't fared too badly. We have seen that capital concentration with three funds that were more than 5 billion euros in size, Blackstone, Goldman Sachs, and Glendower in that case. But I thought that was quite, you know, quite interesting, because at the same time, we are aware that there's plenty of other managers that do smaller secondaries funds, and Klein Hill is one of them, of course, targeting a slightly different market segment. We're also aware that you know, there's new entrants in the market like Astorg. We've also got people who regularly come back to market with secondary strategies like Arcano and Unigestion and Altamar Cam. So there's, you know, just to give you an idea of kind of the secondaries fundraising landscape and who some of the key players are, I think those fundraising figures reflect that fairly well.
I think the data is really interesting here, because if you look at the peak years of 2020 and 2023, they've been what the market would consider down years. 2020 was the year of COVID. We had the difficult macro environment last year, which led to a wider outlook on the drop of exits. And obviously, there's some readjustment from LPs in that instance of where they deploy their capital. And if there's fewer exits, there's more opportunities in the secondaries market. And so, you know, it's a cycle, isn't it? Money plows into wherever there's opportunities at that time.
Mm, yeah, that's a really good point, kind of picking out those years, 2023 and 2020. Many people would say, oh no, that was, you know, that was terrible. But actually, yeah, as you say, LPs are discerning about where they're putting those their capital in those uncertain times. And actually, looking back over the last few years, you know, 342 billion euros total raised for kind of all European PE strategies in 2023 doesn't compare too badly to previous years. So yeah, on that note, I think we'll hear from Eleanor Lally now at Klein Hill Partners, and we'll be back with you after that to discuss some key takeaways. Just quickly, a brief kind of bio on Eleanor. As I said, she's a managing director at US headquartered Klein Hill Partners, and there she focuses on GP-led secondaries. She joined the firm from Partners Group in 2021 and is based in Switzerland. I spoke to her about Klein Hill's GP-led secondary strategy, her outlook for 2024, and why the firm focuses on the lower mid-market segment to find opportunities. Eleanor, hello and welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Harriet. Great to be here.
Well, great to have you, and looking forward to speaking to you about GP-led secondaries today. I know our listeners will be familiar with you and you know, with Klein Hill as a secondaries investor covering GP and LP deals. But I wanted to ask you specifically, you know, we're going to be talking today about GP-leds. Can you maybe start off by just outlining Klein Hill's GP-led strategy and why you chose to focus on this particular market segment that you do focus on?
Of course. At Klein Hill, we focus on continuation funds that are smaller than 250 million in size. So in other words, we're focusing on lower mid-market businesses in both Europe and North America. And within that lower mid-market segment, we focus on how we call it trophy assets, which means these are companies that have done very well for a GP, have generated strong returns for existing investors. And these are companies that the GP doesn't want to let go and want to continue to hold them for longer, but their fund life usually doesn't permit that to do so. And LPs expect like exits after 4 to 5 years of holding. And that's basically where we would come in. And in terms of the company profile, we like businesses that are recession resilient, have low leverage levels, strong margins, and are active in like a attractive growing market segment. And why we like that market segment, I think there's plenty of reasons, to be honest. We particularly like the lower mid-market since it's less competitive. Valuations are more attractive and lower than if you look at the large cap space. You're also not dependent on the IPO market as an exit route. You usually have all the three exit routes open, and the market opportunity is just massive.
Absolutely. Makes sense. And I know Klein Hill obviously operates in both the US and Europe. So can you tell me a little bit about the kind of differences and the nuances between those two markets, particularly when it comes to GP-led secondary deals?
Yeah, the US market is much bigger than the European one. And it's like roughly 2/3 of the deal flow that we see today. So it's also in line with our strategy where we focus on investing roughly 2/3 in the US and 1/3 in Europe. I'd say the US market is more mature. It's also more intermediated and GP-leds have been more commonly used. However, adoption in Europe is increasing quite heavily, but it is still lagging somewhat behind the US, which I think the European market makes it somewhat also very interesting because we almost have like a first mover advantage here. You can still do like lots of education with the lower mid-market GPs and really shape that GP-led market in Europe together.
Yeah, I see. And, you know, thinking about the market this year, GPs are often telling us and advisors as well, actually, that they're hoping for a more favorable environment for exits this year. We're reporting at Merger Market, obviously, on a lot of processes that are being, you know, prepped to come to market. But GP-led secondaries are obviously an exit option that people kind of look to, you know, at least at fund level, albeit that in terms of capital structure, the sponsor will keep kind of, you know, owning the asset typically. So I wanted to ask you, you know, this kind of hope around an increase in exit options, a better exit market, how might that affect the deal flow that you're seeing for GP-led secondaries?
Yeah, it's a great question. We're not worried about deal flow at all. We expect this year to be a record year for secondary volume because the need for liquidity just continues this year. For example, Bain just published their yearly private equity report, and there's 3.2 trillion of unrealized value sitting across 28,000 companies. That's like a 7% increase from last year. And interestingly, 50% of these businesses have been held in portfolios for more than 4 years, which is the highest level since 2012. So there's just this massive backlog in companies that have to be sold in the coming years. So we're basically very excited about the deal flow in the years to come. And on top of that, I would say even if the exit environment becomes more favorable, GPs have really discovered continuation funds as a way to keep their best assets, the trophy assets, for longer. It's almost like established as a fourth exit route. And if you think about like a GP, it's super hard for them to find great companies, the right management teams, etc. So they've really recognized that it's a great tool to don't have to let their best businesses go.
Yes, so I suppose actually the case a GP might be making for going for a kind of standard M&A exit versus the case they might be making for putting an asset in a continuation fund are therefore quite different, or they're quite different types of assets maybe.
Yeah, if you think about it, GP-led, it's often really businesses where GPs think they can do much more value creation with these companies. Like either they have started consolidating the market or they see other ways of expansion in different geographies, and they're not done with their value creation yet. And often these are also businesses where they've generated 3, 4, 5 times for their existing investors, and they expect to do the same again and don't want to let go of these businesses.
Now, you know, obviously with the growing prevalence of GP-led deals, there's kind of more scrutiny applied to them, I suppose. So I wanted to ask you how you would say GPs can get their LPs and secondary buyers aligned and comfortable with valuations on these GP-led deals. We've been hearing, for example, a bit more about GPs potentially selling a minority stake in an asset prior to moving it to a continuation fund. So yes, I'd be interested to hear about how GPs can, you know, get people comfortable and aligned, and how common this potential, you know, minority stake sale ahead of a continuation fund move is as well.
Yeah, we do see some transactions where GP sells a minority stake first before moving a company into a continuation fund. It's, however, a smaller part of the overall GP-led market. And the rationale here is often not the price setting, but rather that the GP wants to bring in another GP on board who has, for example, expertise in a certain area, for example, expansion to different geographies, or capabilities and buy and build strategies. So it's a smaller part of the overall market. Overall, a GP-led process is very similarly run to an M&A process. The due diligence process and price setting is quite extensive. It takes like often 6 to 9 months. However, I'd say one key difference to the M&A process is that we also do due diligence on the manager, who we see if he's actually also the right one to manage that asset. Having said that, I am currently, so the pricing is somewhat more favorable for buyers. The market environment is still pretty tough, and we as buyers have to price in the uncertainty of the market. Sometimes you can solve the price gap between buyers and sellers with like creative structures, such as an earnout, for example. But overall, valuations currently remain pretty attractive for a buyer.
Yeah, great. And thinking about, you know, you have to make returns yourself as a secondaries investor, right? So I'd be interested to hear from you, Elena, about how much more you think the secondaries market, and, you know, GP-led secondaries in particular, still has to prove, you know, when it comes to successful returns. Could 2024 be a year in which we see some of this materialize with exits coming from certain GP-led deals or funds? What's your take on that?
Yeah, definitely. The GP-led market as we have it today is still relatively nascent. It has obviously existed for much longer, but it was less of that trophy asset narrative that I described earlier, but more of like tailored solutions where a GP wanted to solve for the remaining assets in a fund that couldn't be sold, which is completely different to the GP-led on how we do them today. We've seen recent, very promising studies that outline the return potential for GP-leds. One recent study was just published by HSC and Evercore, where they analyzed almost 200 continuation funds. And interestingly, that study found that GP-led returns are roughly in line with buyout funds, but at a much lower return dispersion. So in other words, you get similar returns, but at a lower risk, which is a pretty strong statement for GP-led. And another study by Morgan Stanley, which was also published early in the year, found that the net money multiple for continuation funds is 0.2 times higher than for buyout funds on average, while achieving a meaningful lower loss ratio than buyout funds. So I think these are just two studies that show the beauty of why we really like GP-led. So we're trying to build a very diversified portfolio along strong GPs in different sectors and geographies, buying companies GPs have owned before and know very well. So you have much less surprises. And that also shows why these studies show basically that you have a pretty attractive risk return profile.
Yeah, it's really interesting to see some of those arguments that people often make around it being, you know, less risky potentially engaging in a series of GP-led deals versus a kind of, you know, investing in a blind pool buyout fund kind of thing. Yeah, very interesting to see how some of those arguments are actually coming to fruition in the data we're getting around this asset class or this sub asset class within private equity.
Yeah,
very interesting. And lastly, Elena, I wanted to ask you a bit about sort of the secondaries fundraising market or kind of capital formation market as a whole, I suppose, because, you know, there's plenty of opportunities. You've mentioned them yourself with Klein Hill's kind of lower mid-market focus, but, you know, there's all sorts of different size brackets that secondaries buyers operating elsewhere, and just the availability of capital to do these deals that we've been talking about is something that always comes up when I ask market participants about the growth of the markets. And, you know, people typically seem to be saying to me, you know, there's plenty of opportunities, GPs are very keen on taking advantage of this, but, you know, the question is, can secondaries funds actually keep pace with that demand, so they're there to provide the capital? You know, what's your take on that? And how do you think this kind of question around the availability of capital is likely to develop in the next 12 months or so?
Yeah, that's a very good point. And it's true that the secondary market has been quite capital constrained in the past couple of months, meaning there was not enough capital for the deal flow that was available. However, that has changed for 2024. 23 has been, in general, like a very tough and challenging fundraising market, but it was a very successful year for secondary fundraising, and the dry powder levels today are actually pretty strong. So one could ask, okay, what does that mean now for our competition, right? Interestingly, around 80% of that capital has been raised in like very large billion funds, and hence I do expect more competition for deals that are bigger than 500 million in size. So it doesn't really impact us so much at Klein Hill, where we focus on smaller transactions. It might even have like a little bit of a more positive impact because these large players are even more focused on the large deals. So that even opens a bit of a bigger gap in that mid-sized transactions for us.
Interesting. And if I could actually ask you one final question, Elena, I know you've said that, you know, you've mentioned a few factors that are interesting for Klein Hill when you're looking at these deals. You're looking for companies that are recession resilient and, you know, operating in growing market segments. Is there any kind of advice you would give to GPs or to intermediaries that are looking to, you know, to work with Klein Hill or to bring you deals? Is there anything else that you particularly, you know, want to see or want to be shown in those kinds of, you know, when you're sourcing deals, those kinds of situations?
Yeah, I think a very important element that we haven't touched on yet is the alignment. We're very much focused on being aligned with the GP and also the underlying management teams. So on average, we see in our deals like a GP commitment of 9%, which is also like very high if you compare it to traditional buyout funds. And that's like super important for us that the GP is really committed for the next couple of years and aligned with us to basically bring that company or companies to the next level.
I see. Yeah, very interesting. So you'll be looking for GPs to make sure that they're committing, same as, you know, many LPs would, I suppose, in a kind of typical flagship fund.
That's correct, yeah.
Well, thank you again, Elena, for taking the time to speak to me. It's been great to have you on the podcast. Thank you again to Elena for taking the time to speak to me. I think it was really interesting to hear her outlook, and clearly she isn't concerned about a potential increase in private equity exits leading to GP-led deal flow drying up. At the same time, she mentioned that these processes can take 6 to 9 months. Now, you know, a GP-led secondary deal, it's easy to forget it's a deal, but it is actually a fundraise as well. You've got to get your existing LPs or at least a portion of them on board. You've got to make sure your secondary investors are on board and they need time to do their due diligence, as she said. So I thought, you know, although there are clearly very strong arguments in certain cases to make to do these kinds of deals or funds, it's, you know, not quite as difficult as a blind pool fundraise, for example, where you're not aware as an investor which assets you might have exposure to. But it's also not something that GPs will be kind of entering into lightly.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of things going on here. The lower mid-market angle is especially interesting. A lot of the funds that you spoke about, Harriet, in the intro are predominantly focused on bigger ticket continuation vehicles, and there is less competition on the secondaries front in this lower mid-market space. But if you look at the overall pool of M&A deals, I was just pulling some data before we came down to record this podcast. So for deals that were valued below 100 million euros, that's kind of whereabouts we're pegging the small cap market at the moment, there were 430 private equity exits last year, which is down from 650 in 2020 and nearly 1,000 at the peak market in 2021. So again, there are a couple of things going on. So there's still been a lot of exits. I think we covered the large cap in a podcast not long ago, and there had been a handful, maybe 5 large cap exits over the past year. So A, there's more. And so you can transact for a good asset in this environment, whether that be a full one or a continuation vehicle. But if we normalize that kind of M&A volume and we pick up on what hasn't traded through 2020 and 2023, then there's like a whole pool of, you know, nearly 1,000 companies that maybe should have traded and didn't, plus all of the ones that are upcoming as well. So I think, you know, when we do look at deal flow, it is big.
Definitely. And Elena obviously mentioned that, I suppose, with that in mind, there's a lot of kind of education and, I suppose, ultimately relationship building that's going to go into kind of tapping into some of those opportunities. You know, GPs are aware that they can tap the secondaries market, but, you know, some of our listeners can tell me, maybe they will know, but perhaps, you know, it used to be more the domain of the kind of large cap investors. And, you know, the perception may have been that it wasn't quite, you know, there for the smaller ones. But, you know, thinking about the kind of exit prospect ultimately for these continuation funds, often the assets going into them are a lot larger than when they were, you know, first bought, and give them another, you know, 3, 4, 5 years in these continuation funds, the universe of buyers that will be looking at them, they may no longer be kind of lower mid-market deals. So that's a kind of, that's another interesting aspect as well when we come to think of continuation fund returns and continuation fund exits. Elena obviously mentioned that the IPO route isn't a route that they're so reliant on for their own exits at Clienthill, whereas some continuation funds we've seen in the larger space, clearly the ultimate exit route is going to be IPO, and it's about when the timing's right for that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I feel you asked me at the beginning of this about one thing that's changed, which we didn't have quite time to cover, but I want to bring up now, is the due diligence on the GP as well. Mm. We know there's been a lot more due diligence going into assets throughout the M&A process. It's protracted in the run-up to a launch. but there's so much conversation all the time I'm having with sources around consolidation and fallout within the manager space as well. And the risk reward profile is only going to be good if you have a trusted view on the GP. So it's as much about what the GP does with its asset, this one in particular, how much has it grown it, what has it done with perhaps any other secondaries vehicles that they've had in the past, a wider look at their portfolio before, you know, you're not just making a bet on that asset, you're making a bet on the GP's ability to manage that asset properly.
Yeah, really good point. And again, there's something that Elena kind of touched on when she said, you know, I think you're looking at whether this manager is the right manager to keep managing this particular
asset. And we're seeing that increasingly in the co-investment space. LPs are increasingly selective on who they're committing to. I think, yeah, there's good and there's bad managers, and I think this is just part of the bifurcation of that market as well, deciding who's good and who's bad.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, secondaries investors will obviously be discerning, and they will find out fairly quickly whether these deals are ones they want to commit to. You know, hopefully being able to give a quick no is helpful to GPs in those cases. But, you know, hopefully for our listeners, they will be able to kind of, you know, do these vehicles as and when they want to, you know, reasonably successfully. And I know we've reported on a few deals, you know, in the low mid market space, for example, and also ones that Klein Hill has been active in. Did you want to, you know, run through a few of those examples, Rachel?
Yeah, sure, because I think these are quite interesting in themselves. So in terms of, and again, because you know, talking about PR spin at the beginning, I think most GP-led deals do tend to be kept quite secretive. There's not normally kind of the whole hurrah around press releases when they are closed. Sometimes there is, but not always. So some of the ones we've picked up on. So Klein Hill was involved in a Horizon Capital vehicle for its fire safety asset, Church's Fire. That was from Merger Market Reporting. And another interesting deal that I picked up on actually was they got involved with a vehicle from a family office, which is not something that we've covered more widely. I think people think of this as a private equity toolbox. And obviously most family offices don't have funds, but where they do, it's still an option. So Swiss Family Office Varium announced a continuation vehicle for two of its companies, Toridex and Mobile in Time. And then there's a few others ongoing in the market as well that I thought was worth mentioning. So French sponsor Montefiore has recently set up a four asset continuation vehicle, which included two that had already partially monetized through other routes like minority stake sales, which I know was something that you discussed in the interview. And Portobello Capital is also raising a fund for Blue Seas Hotel, where it might even look to bring in an infrastructure manager as a partner. So there are all kinds of different strategies going into these kinds of vehicles, different monetization routes. It's a creative industry. It's an exciting time. Let's see where it goes.
Yeah, definitely. And we're already seeing, you know, innovation. We had an Article 9, so sort of, you know, impact, depending on how you define that, but an Article 9 continuation fund by Summa Equity back in December 2023 for its environmental services provider, NG Group, which was interesting to see. And we've seen advisors innovating as well. We don't have time to get into that whole topic now, but of course our listeners will be aware there's been plenty of, you know, lateral hiring, plenty of acquisitions as well in this space. So, you know, the kind of advisory and intermediary community at the same time is looking to make sure that they kind of stay on top of this appetite for deals in this space and can essentially pitch, you know, different options to the GPs that they work with on a regular basis. I know just over a year ago, Campbell Lutyens and JP Morgan announced a strategic partnership for that very purpose.
Yeah, it's on the fund side and the advisor side. So Houlihan Lokey acquired Triago, which has a big secondaries advisory unit. Bridgepoint has, the fund has spoken in its full year results about possibly acquiring a secondaries manager. We know that there's been so much consolidation in that space. So it does really seem like people are going all in on secondaries, whether that be the capital advisory front or the capital deployment front.
Yeah, definitely. I know, again, we're, you know, GP-led secondaries is a really interesting topic, and it's kind of linked to a lot of the topics that we have talked about and like talking about on the podcast. So, you know, exits and industry consolidation, which are both still going on, I think, to shape 2024, albeit we're only a few months in. So we'll have to see where this goes.
Absolutely.
Well, I think we'll wrap up there. But thank you, Rachel, for joining me. As always, great to chat about this with you.
Thank you very much, Harriet.
And thank you again to Elena Lale from Klein Hill Partners for taking the time to come on the podcast. And thank you, of course, listener, for tuning in again. If you like the podcast, then please don't forget to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And we'll see you again in the next episode.